Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Brought to you by PwC. We balance business understanding with technology innovation and human insight. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we take a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by Brad Smith, President at Microsoft. Brad, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're talking to you specifically because of the recent launch of your first book, Tools and Weapons, The Promise and the Peril of the Digital Age. That title obviously balanced between the benefits and the threats, I suppose, that the digital revolution poses. A lot of people think perhaps we've already gone past the tipping point where tech and the big tech companies such as your own are more weaponized than benign, and that there's a loss of trust by the general public, even as we use your products, about you.
When you really think about it, any tool can be turned into a weapon. One of the points that Carol Ann Brown, my co-author, and I make is that even a broom can be used to sweep a floor or hit somebody over the head. And when you put it in that context, what you realize is that the more powerful the tool, the more formidable the weapon. Digital technology today is very powerful. It's a tool that will do and does do a lot of good for the world, but it has been weaponized, and there are real issues that we need to address head on.
At least you can see a broom if it's coming towards you, Brad. One of the problems with digital products, digital services, and the companies that offer them is that we actually don't know how we're being used by them.
I think that's a fair point, and what it really points to is the importance of greater transparency. And that's one of the arguments we, in effect, advance through the book. It's a book that is fundamentally about stories, because that's not just what people enjoy reading about, but it's what helps us learn. And, you know, when we think about the protection of our democracies, when we think about what it takes to protect Ireland in an important election next year, there's both a lot to be learned from threats to democracy in the past. We talk some about that. But we also talk about the point that you basically make. If we can't have more transparent technology and services, if we don't have more information from governments, then the hacking of candidates' emails, the potential vulnerability of voting, or the broader disinformation on social media risks getting worse rather than better. So these are important issues, and I think the so-called invisibility of digital data and code is one of the attributes we actually have to grapple with.
You've been with Microsoft since 1993. You're the most senior executive to bridge from the Bill Gates era up to today. In the book, you outline how proactive Microsoft has become, largely under your guidance in trying to foster more trust, in trying to bring other digital peers along with you to do the right thing proactively in terms of respecting data privacy, almost encouraging regulation. Microsoft wasn't always so proactive, though.
One of the things we tried to do in this book is pull back the curtain, if you will, on the mistakes that we ourselves had made and talk about them in a more candid and honest way. At Microsoft, we had our day on the antitrust hot seat in the 1990s. The U.S. government sought to break Microsoft up. We share what we learned from our mistakes, in part so others can learn from our mistakes rather than be forced to learn from their own. But more than that, we just think that there's a broad conversation for the public. This technology and tech companies affect all of us. They impact our jobs. They impact how we learn and socialize with each other. And the only way we're going to address this new generation of challenges is actually to meet them head on, be more forthright, and develop more concrete solutions. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about the skills needed for our jobs or what it takes to bring broadband to rural communities. These really are issues of our time.
Not all the tech companies are on the same wavelength as you, though, and that emerges from the book. I think the likes of Facebook and Google have reached out to you recently because of the privacy issues that they've faced. They've become more collaborative with you, but you reference Apple at times, and you reference, almost without naming them, the other company on the other side of Seattle, Amazon, who aren't as proactive as you, who seem to be waiting to be regulated, and who perhaps are mistrustful and suspicious of why you and Microsoft are reaching out.
I think our industry is starting to go through the change that it in fact needs increasingly to embrace. You know, our book is in part a call for governments to move faster. It's also a call for the tech sector to change. One of the points we make is that technology has actually been rippling around the world since the Industrial Revolution first started in the middle of the 1700s. But if you look over this period of time, there has never been a major technology that has gone unregulated as long as digital technology has gone unregulated. And so part of our message is to encourage people in some ways, just imagine what we see, which is there is a future in which there are guardrails on technology, companies can move fast down the road, but the public will have better protection, and as a result, the public may have more trust in technology. That's the future we're actually asking people to pursue.
So move fast with a guardrail, as you put it, rather than move fast and break things, as one of your competitors put it. I mean, you reference, and there are some wonderful stories in the book reaching right back to ancient Greece, up to your meetings with Obama and the Pope and Angela Merkel, but you reference a meeting with Obama when he was president and you were looking for stuff for his administration to move on something, and he said the guns will turn on you, the tech companies at some stage. Do you think the guns will turn on the likes of Amazon if they don't move quickly with you? The banks were regulated in the 1930s in the United States, and they didn't discriminate which banks were regulated.
I think the guns already have turned. You're right. We shared the story of the meeting that took place in the West Wing of the White House in the Roosevelt Room just before Christmas in 2013, and describe how the tech leaders, including me, I was one of the individuals present, were all encouraging President Obama to put more checks and balances on the NSA, the National Security Agency in the United States. And President Obama did predict at that meeting that the guns would turn. And the day they turned, actually, was last year in 2018, when suddenly the Cambridge Analytica issue exploded. And while Facebook might have been the first company that was connected with this new political environment, so to speak, it's really something that has affected every tech company and will continue to do so. And in our view, the only way to grapple with these issues is to acknowledge that the concerns are not just real, they're legitimate. And we have to address the questions and the problems that are bothering people.
What do you say to those who would say that Microsoft doesn't have as much skin in the game in terms of personal privacy because it's not in the whole social media space, and therefore it suits Microsoft to advocate a more collaborative regulatory approach with governments and civic society because it'll actually slow down some of its competitors?
Well, our goal is not to slow down innovation for anyone. It is true that we have a business model that is less reliant on things like targeted advertising and the like. But I think it would be naive for us to think that one can put regulatory guardrails in place and not be affected by them ourselves. We clearly will be. We have our own social media service, LinkedIn, for example.
Of course.
We have other services that will be affected. Ultimately, our message is that if you want to move fast, if you want to drive your car fast down the road, you're better off driving on a road that has guardrails. You're much less likely to have an accident. You're much less likely to have to spend your time dealing with the damage that you cause to yourself and others. And so from any kind of mid to long-term perspective, our fundamental argument is that this will enable the industry to move forward faster in a sustained way and in a way that just does what it should do for the rest of society and not have companies thinking about their interests alone.
you started your Microsoft career in the early 1990s in Paris, and you personally seem to have more of a European sensibility, if I could put it that way, about the need, the requirement to protect privacy and personal data, more of a, than a US sensibility. You talk about that visit to the former Stasi prison in East Berlin last winter, where it really came home to you for the absolute need to protect personal information and privacy. You support the GDPR regulations that have come in Europe, but the United States is still suspicious of all of that, or laggard in bringing it in. Do you think it's inevitable?
I do think that stronger privacy protection is inevitable, and I believe it's good for the world. And you're right, we are unabashedly supportive of the leadership that Europe has taken, really not just protecting privacy for Europeans, but creating a model that we do believe is a valuable model for the world. We believe that the best hope for privacy globally is for Europe to use its voice and for the rest of the world to listen to that voice. And we really call out two countries, perhaps more than any other in Europe, Germany as the place that offers the lessons that can be learned from both the Nazi and Stasi era of what can go wrong, how much things can go wrong when you don't have protection of privacy or fundamental democratic freedoms. And then we talk about Ireland, a country that, as we say in the book, as I've said on trips to the Middle East, we believe that Ireland is to data what Switzerland is to money. People want to store their money in Switzerland. They should want to store their data in Ireland, because we really see Ireland as a country that has been on the forefront of cloud computing and data storage and data protection, not just over the last few years, but for the last couple of decades.
You are very complimentary about the data protection regime in Ireland. You say it's strong but pragmatic. But as you know, it has been the focus of a lot of criticism across Europe, because we are now the focus of data protection, because so many large US tech companies are headquartered in Ireland. A lot of criticism that we haven't moved quickly enough and strongly enough from Ireland to tackle some of the abuses of privacy and misuse of data.
Well, I have the opportunity in my job to meet with data protection officials literally around the world. I don't think you meet data protection officials anywhere that are more capable, more focused, more principled, are more pragmatic than the officials here in Ireland. And I think that's a good thing. That is, in fact, exactly what the world needs, because I think people fundamentally want their privacy to be protected, but they do want officials who can deal with, you know, what are very complex and practical questions in a pragmatic way. One can be principled, but if one doesn't understand the technology or how it works or what it takes to make it better, then there's a huge risk of unintended consequences. And I think one of the many things I appreciate about the data protection officials here in Ireland is their ability to not just stand true for the principles of privacy protection, but actually understand how this technology works. That's what is going to impact people.
Without challenging your judgment or questioning your bona fides on that at all, Brad, some people might say you would say that about our regulator here, because Microsoft has developed such an enormous interest and campus and roots in Ireland.
Well, one of the points that we make in our book is that sometimes people across Europe look at Ireland and they say it's an attractive place because taxes are low, or they say it's an attractive place because the rules are more pragmatic. We actually point out that the most attractive thing about Ireland is the climate, not the weather, but the legal protections. We point to what happened in Germany with the Stasi. We make the point that Ireland, in many ways, is the last place you would ever expect or worry that these kinds of protections are going to be lost. And I'll also be quick to say, the data protection officials in Ireland do push us. That's their job. They do what they're paid to do and they do it well. And I'm also quick to say that they push us to be better. And you know, there are days when you may not like to be pushed, but you learn that when people push you to be better, you get better. And by getting better, we better serve the public. We better serve our customers. We create better technology to enable our customers to use our services to protect their data and their customers' data. So I believe that, in fact, what we're in the course of doing is progressively getting better each year. And that's what we just need to keep doing into the foreseeable future, given how much more digital data there is on each of us as individuals each year.
You tell a great story, and I think our listeners would love to hear it, about the can-do approach of Irish officials you met way back in the 1980s when you were thinking of placing a data centre here, but we didn't have the capacity or capability to host it at that stage.
Well, to me, it is an incredibly inspiring story, as you point out, not just about Ireland, but about what a really good government and government official and agency can do when they are forward looking. The point we basically make is that Microsoft was the first tech company to invest in Ireland. This was in the 1980s. We put our manufacturing of software at the time on CDs and DVDs in Ireland. But the Irish government recognized in the 1990s that the day of software on CDs would come to an end. And if the Irish economy was going to continue to be prosperous and create more jobs, it would need to look to the future. So they came, and I still remember it was a visit led by an Irish official, Ronald Long, and they made the case, build your first data center for Europe in Ireland. And I looked across the table and said, look, we love Ireland, but we can't. The reason we can't is there is no high-speed fiber optic cable connecting Ireland with the European continent. And without a cable, it doesn't make sense to have a European data center. And the Irish officials looked across the table at me and said, give us 3 months. And given how much we had benefited from our work and our employees here in Ireland, there was no way we could say no to that. And 3 months later, they had the contract in place. They were well on their way to having the fiber optic cable in place. And you look today, I'd say the rest is history. Ireland is a country that has only 1% of the European Union's population. But as we say in the book, it is a data superpower. And there are jobs here. There are people that have come here. There are people who have grown up here. And I trace a lot of that benefit to that decision made more than two decades ago.
You have data centers, and other tech companies have data centers all around the world now because of the intensity of use. Data centers need to be closer to those who are using it. But you say that Microsoft does a very tight human rights audit over a country before they will place a data center there, and you review the findings of all those audits. That means, I presume, there won't be a Microsoft data center in China anytime soon.
Well, what we make clear is we have a human rights assessment before we ever put a data center in a new country. There are some places we don't put data centers. There are some places where we will put data centers, but we will strongly limit the kinds of data we will put in a particular country. We have some data centers in China for business customers to have business data. We don't put our consumer services and our consumer data in those data centers. That's true of some data centers in other countries. And then there are countries where we've just decided we're not comfortable having a data center at all. To me, what it really speaks to, and what we really try to describe in the book, is how important these decisions are for people. And fundamentally, the question is, when do you put a citizen's data, consumer data, in a country? And we think this is really one of the most important human rights issues of our time, because it can affect people so directly if a government, an authoritarian government, can access their personal data.
And by implication, Brad, regardless of what level of security you and other well-resourced tech companies might take to protect personal data in an overseas data center, what you're saying there is always the danger of it being hacked and stolen.
Yeah, there's really two dangers when you put data in a country. One is obviously that the government uses its search warrants or legal authority to compel you to turn it over. The second danger, which is really a global danger, is this danger of cyber attacks. It's why we go to some length in the book to share the stories about what happened in May and June of 2017. We share the story of the WannaCry attack, which really took down a third of the hospitals in the National Health Service in the United Kingdom. You know, we share what it meant for specific patients who were scheduled for surgery that day. We share what it meant at a company like Microsoft as we scrambled to understand what was happening, to respond, not just to protect customers, which was the first priority, but to address the broader geopolitical impact of an attack that on that day was launched by the North Korean government and impacted more than 150 nations in a single day. The world had never in human history seen an attack by one country that impacted 150 other countries in the course of a day.
And you point out in the book that that WannaCry virus was probably developed by the US military and it got stolen, used probably by North Korea. But you point out that governments, including your own, are probably slow to tackle the whole area of cybercrime and the dangers it raises because they see it as a weapon they may use themselves, a weapon they may use without being detected, without their fingerprints on it. You point out that the world may wake up someday, unless governments act, to a cybercrime 9/11.
Absolutely. It's one of the reasons that motivated us to write this book. We think that the world needs to learn more about how code is being turned into a weapon, how some governments are using it as a weapon, how some countries may be stockpiling these weapons. It's impossible for us to protect ourselves if we don't understand more about these dangers. And especially when we think about what the democratic governments of the world need to do, both to protect against these cyber attacks and to pursue the right kinds of policies so that we don't create greater digital threats. It needs a public conversation. And we can't have a public conversation without providing the public with more information. That was our goal.
You're fascinating about artificial intelligence, and it's both encouraging and deeply frightening the way you write about it, that artificial intelligence isn't just another useful product like an iPhone. It's like electricity. It changes the game. And with the capacity we have now for storage of data in the cloud, with hugely intensified computing power, and now the ability of machines to learn and take actions based on all that data that's up there, it's a scary future we're moving into, isn't it?
One of the points we really try to share with the readers of our book is that artificial intelligence is creating the capability for machines to make decisions that throughout human history could only be made by human beings. It is a game changer. Now, there's so many positive uses that will come from this. We believe that AI will probably literally help the world cure cancer over the next decade. But the other side of the coin is also profound. One of the favorite stories that really speaks to us was the opportunity that my co-author, Carol Ann, and I had to go to the Vatican earlier this year. And, you know, it was a day, as we share in the book, where we saw one of the first Gutenberg Bibles. We saw the letters that Galileo had written to the Pope to make the case for his innocence. We capture this centuries-old intersection or tension between science and technology on the one hand, and faith and values and religion on the other hand. And then we tell the story of meeting with Pope Francis. And when the conversation with Pope Francis concluded, he said something to me that we share in the book that I believe speaks to every one of us. He said, "Keep your humanity." You know, the tech sector is bringing technology to humanity. But I think his message is perhaps even more important. It's make sure we're ensuring that humanity is protected and thought about as we create and deploy technology. This has to be, in our view, you know, one of the most fundamental messages for our time.
And you point out that any military cadet in the United States has to do a course in ethics. You believe coders, who increasingly will drive the artificial intelligence game, need to be balanced and in some way by humanities, by history, by ethics.
Absolutely. Having spent more than 2.5 decades in the tech sector, I appreciate, on the one hand, the fundamental role that engineers, computer scientists, data scientists play in the creation of technology. But as we look to the future, as we think about artificial intelligence, this needs to become more of a multidisciplinary endeavor. We need more people from the humanities, from the social sciences, involved in the creation of technology, especially artificial intelligence. If we're going to give computers the ability to make decisions that have been made by human beings, then we should want those decisions to reflect the best of humanity. And the only way to do that is to bring more people together from all of the fields that are important to humanity.
Bringing things right back to the present, Brad, and right back to current day politics, your collaborative approach, where you know you believe the large tech companies such as your own need to welcome reasonable regulation, collaborative approach with governments, with civic society. A lot of people would argue that that's, you know, leaving the fox in charge of the henhouse in many ways. Do you not think it's inevitable, particularly if a Democratic president gets in next year, that you're going to be broken up, just like the railroads were broken up in their time and AT&T was broken up?
I don't believe that is inevitable. I believe that what we need to do is decide what problems we want to solve, and we need to then identify the best ways to solve them. There are all kinds of possible approaches. From our perspective, one of the most compelling approaches in 2019 is the encounter that we share in the book, meeting with Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern in the capital of New Zealand less than 2 weeks after the Christchurch terrorist attack. And having her say, look, I'm not interested in generating public relations points. I want to try to solve a problem. How can we work together to make the internet safer so that terrorists don't use it as a stage to, you know, stage, as they did that day in March, mass shootings? To me, that speaks to the power of political leaders that want to solve practical problems by moving fast in collaboration with nonprofit groups, with tech companies, with others in the business community. It doesn't mean that there won't be days when broader or more onerous regulations are not adopted. We get that. But we have so much that we can accomplish by working together and moving faster on a multilateral basis and on a multi-stakeholder basis.
We'll leave it there. It's been a pleasure. That's Brad Smith, president at Microsoft and author of Tools and Weapons, The Promise and the Peril of the Digital Age. Brad, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.
We're joined now by Michael O'Sullivan, economist and author of Ireland and the Global Question, and his latest book called The Leveling, What's Next After Globalization. Michael, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Vincent, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Now, as the Brexit clocks tick down, Michael, we're going to discuss the changes that will impact both the Irish and UK economies after Britain leaves the EU. Let's talk about Ireland first. You've written about the links that Ireland is making with other smaller open economies in the Scandinavian areas, Northern Europe, in the new Hanseatic League. But we're going to need to think differently as an economy without Britain at our side in Brussels, aren't we? We're still we think in the same way as the British do about the economy generally, and our trading links are still very strong.
You're right. So as we approach the end of October, we're now in the fog of Brexit and the noise of Brexit. And there are some very, very big decisions and challenges to come right after Brexit. So one of them, I think, is the economic model and the political and diplomatic model Ireland will have in the post-Brexit era. And for a long time, I think in Brussels, Ireland has always used both the policy templates the British had, and it's also used Britain as a kind of a diplomatic crutch in Brussels. That, I have to say, is changing. I think Irish diplomacy is doing very well through the lens of Brexit and is beginning to expand further abroad. But I think we're not there yet in terms of the mentality, you know, of being the only English-speaking country in Europe. And I think what's interesting also is that European elites, be it in Brussels or Paris, are much, much less obsessed with Brexit than we are, maybe that London is. And they're focused on other things. And I think the new commission is a sign of that. And some of the areas they're focused on, I think, will be challenging from an Irish point of view. Corporate tax is a big issue. Other ones, such as the need for a pan-European industrial policy, I think ultimately can be helpful, but that's not part of our natural policy setting here.
Do you think that in terms of the linkages we're trying to make with the likes of the Scandinavian countries, with the Benelux countries, that we're going to have to do like they've done, start thinking very long term in terms of our investment in human capital, in industrial capital, in technological capital, and start building up our own industrial champions, however we do that, rather than relying to the extent we have on foreign direct investment, which will be threatened to some degree by tax changes anyway?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think we have a good starting point that we have all of these multinationals in Ireland. They are feeding expertise, innovation into the economy. And there are signs that Irish companies and universities and sort of clusters are beginning to pick up on that. I think the whole idea of the small country model, so small advanced states, will become much more important, not just in Europe, but across the world as growth begins to slow and people look around for economic resilience, and they will look to the likes, as you say, of Sweden, Switzerland, etc. And, you know, we have some of those attributes. The one thing we're missing really is, if you compare Ireland to, say, Sweden or Switzerland, are big domestic Irish companies. And that's partly due to our economic history, but also partly due to the fact that we focused on outside multinationals rather than our own. And I think that is probably the next chapter in Ireland's economic history. It'll take a long time, but the seeds need to be planted now. And the reality, I think, is that it has to be done in the pan-European context. First of all, the context of what industries are developing in other countries, what are the policy forces. So one that's clearly coming out of the EU now is green technology. There's a lot of policy effort being put into that.
Where we are today is partly, as you say, a function of history, our dependence, our very successful dependence to date on multinational investment, which we've leveraged through our geography, our language and our tax policy. But we haven't invested. We're poor, relatively speaking, in terms of investment generally in research and development, longer term innovation, and also in our third level institutions. They're crying out for cash.
They are crying out for cash. I think, you know, at the margins, more and more of them are beginning to adopt this kind of entrepreneurial approach. And you have it in extremists in countries like Israel and some of the other small states. So it takes a long time. What I hope doesn't happen is that we have a sort of a global corporate tax debate crisis that sort of rushes us into that. And I think there are some very good templates to follow. And I think we have a good starting point in that it is an open economy. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this is the European country that's got the closest cultural ties to the US as well, which is an important source of funding and innovation. But I think this policy needs to begin to be put into place now as we head towards the beginning of Brexit.
In an increasingly volatile world, and you've written about this in The Leveling, about how we are now entering a multipolar world, and the securities and I suppose fixed positions of power of the past are breaking down. You sound broadly optimistic that we'll do okay.
I think we will do okay because we are, I hope we're now diplomatically and politically kind of embedded in the EU. I think other parts of the world, maybe mid-sized countries, Australia, Japan, the UK, Russia, will find themselves a bit more lost because the world I see evolving is we move away from globalization towards a multipolar world, made up of the US, Europe, and China. We are unlike the UK, we're part of the EU. I think the risk for Ireland is that so many of the developments in this country in the last 30 years, go back to the idea of Ireland and the global question, had been carried by globalization, that if globalization changes or comes to an end, that will inevitably affect us. I think so far, if you look at the last 3 or 4 years, trade to GDP globally has actually been quite flat and our economy has been growing. It's simply a question of being prudent in one way and sort of harvesting those gains and then putting them to work for the longer term future.
You live in Paris, you travel all over Europe all the time. Do you think that culturally, intellectually, we have to look beyond our traditional, perhaps almost lazy relationship with our next door neighbours and their language and culture and start investing more in European languages, in sending our kids to work in European manufacturing or professional services, in sending them to European colleges, that we need to make that mind shift intellectually that we're European rather than just Atlanticists?
Absolutely. I think we've always had the luxury and we've maybe coddled ourselves that on one hand we're sort of Celts and the other we're part of, some people see us being part of the British Isles, others see us as being Europeans and others see us as being cousins of America. And this is now a world that's evolving where countries like Ireland will be forced more to choose. And we are legally, economically, we're embedded in Europe. And I think there's some very, very practical things we can do. We're not a country that's good at languages. If I go to Switzerland or Germany, I'm always embarrassed that people there speak not just very good English, but also good Italian and French, etc. And that's one way of developing a very pragmatic link between Ireland and Spain and France and Germany. And I'd like to see that done in a more practical way where, Irish young people are given the resource to maybe to work in other European countries and develop their language skills in a pragmatic way.
You've been writing recently as well about the UK economy after it leaves the EU and whatever way that happens. And you don't seem as optimistic. They're obviously a big economy. They will continue to have 65 million people, a big internal economy. But you don't seem as optimistic about their direction of travel.
I'm not optimistic for a couple of reasons. One, I think there is not the sufficient level of urgency in Westminster as to what the real underlying problems are in the UK. And I think Brexit has given the Theresa Mays, the Corbyns, etc., a bit of a policy holiday in that they've been able to focus on the Brexit debate without really addressing some of the underlying issues. And those underlying issues, I think, have provoked Brexit. So you've had austerity, you've had the hollowing out of public goods, the NHS we've heard recently. The labour market in the UK has become very strange because lots of people are sacrificing security for flexibility. So you have this this gig economy, which is, I think, created quite a vulnerable and lower quality kind of labour market. And then behind that, productivity in the UK is at a multi-decade, a multi-century low. And that's the real driver of growth. And I do feel a lot of these things have been lost sight of. And I think when we get beyond Brexit, someone needs to pick up that debate. And I suspect it will be the next generation of politicians in their 40s, mid-40s now, who will have to take that up. So I don't yet see the urgency for that.
That change to, a more insecure but more flexible gig-type economy that's particularly pronounced in a European setting in the United Kingdom, how has that happened, do you think? I mean, is it a function of national policy over there? Because at one level, they are trying to position themselves as the Singapore of Northern Europe. And Singapore does have that flexibility built in, doesn't it?
To a lesser degree, actually. Singapore has got some interesting characteristics. If you look at the Singaporean housing market, a lot of that is controlled, actually, in terms of where prices and rent go. So if you compare housing in Singapore to Hong Kong, and they're sort of, it's a tale of two cities. Housing is much more affordable in Singapore than it is in Hong Kong, which is one of the more expensive cities in the world. In the UK, I think the hollowing out of the labour market has happened partly by choice in big metropolitan areas like London, partly by pressure from companies who don't want long-term contracts. So they if you like, open the way for people to take these more flexible contracts, and also driven by cost. And one of the side effects is people build up lower pensions, you've got lower social security, and there's probably not as much learning and innovation coming out of the labour market as a result of that.
The UK also has a very different approach to both finance, how both businesses and households are funded, and I suppose longer term investment than particularly the Germans, yeah, with their Mittelstand and generations of very large businesses within families, but investing for the future. Things are much more rapid changing in the UK, aren't they?
They are. So there's it's become a bit of a caricature, but it is true that in Germany and Italy, for example, you get far many more family businesses who are third, fourth, fifth generation. And they have a very long-term outlook. They invest more, as you say, they spend more on R&D. Whereas in the UK, if someone sets up a business, the object is to sell it on, to do an IPO or sell it on to someone else. And then you have big differences in financing. Traditionally, the UK has been shorter term, longer term in Europe. And I think today the issue we have where rates are zero kind of negates that difference, although it does mean that some people in certain parts of the UK economy, housing, for example, have taken on lots of debt at zero rates. And if rates go up, then they become more vulnerable.
Whatever happens at government level in the UK after Brexit, and it could be quite a volatile period, which won't help us either, whoever is in charge that actually starts looking beyond the immediate crisis and what does the European UK economy require, it will not change overnight, will it?
Will not change overnight. No, changing country economic models is a hard thing to do. It's it's just hardwired into culture. You know, we have our own culture here. Often it can happen by crisis. It can also happen by enlightened policymaking. But it's a very, very hard thing to do because it's hardwired into the way people look at the world, into laws, etc. So it takes a really grand scale realization that things have gone off course. And I would hope that Brexit is the manifestation of this, for people to adopt a different view.
You don't seem to be too optimistic about the vision of a free trading Britain post Brexit, freed from the shackles of European regulations and all of that, doing deals globally, becoming a free trading champion, and bringing prosperity to its people. As somebody pointed out to me, the last time they were very good at this kind of thing, the Royal Navy's gunboats tended to be in the local harbour.
Exactly. And, the notion of global trade and globalisation was built effectively off the back of the Royal Navy. I'm not, as you can probably guess, a fan of Brexit in the sense that it will liberate Britain to grow its economy and adopt a very distinct place in the world. And I don't think the current political generation are equipped to do that. And there is a misnomer that, they keep talking about free trade. There's no free trade. What they will have and what they should want is trade under clear rules and regulations. They've got that at the moment with the EU. And if you get, for example, a hard Brexit, as people in Ireland understand very well, then you cut yourself loose from those. And it's like going outside and you take away the road signs and the markings in the road and you have chaos. And Britain is a diminished power, and it will be at a disadvantage in dealing with the likes of China, the States, etc., and will have to make quite big and unpopular compromises. And that's why I think in terms of focusing the debate on free trade, they need to focus that on the domestic economy and what is going to produce long-term organic growth and boost productivity.
Are we then, in your view, looking at binary outcomes in the United Kingdom, say, over the next 5 years, that perhaps, from our perspective, they'll come to their senses and seek to come back in some way, or else that the United Kingdom itself could actually come apart?
I think it will come apart, and I think the irony of the hard Brexiteers is that in seeking to so-called liberate Britain, they will smash everything. They'll smash history. the future of Ireland, Northern Ireland, would be very different. I think they will break the union. There's a growing and quite resolute mood in Scotland now that Scotland should be independent, and all of the arguments the Brexiteers use for breaking free from Europe also apply to Scotland. So we shouldn't be surprised if Scotland is on the road to independence very soon, maybe within 1 or 2 years. So I think if you look at parties in the UK, they may well break the Tory party. There are yet 1 or 2 more new parties who are going to come into the political scene in the UK. The only positive thing is I think, and I do admire the English for being very pragmatic and no nonsense. And I think in the big scheme of things, the end of the first cut, if you like, or the first fracture in the end of globalization was Brexit. So they've gone into this first, followed by America, other countries like Italy, and they will probably be the first to emerge. But that process of, you know, finding new ideas and methods and models is quite a noisy and difficult one.
And where do you think that will leave Northern Ireland?
So I think one of the things that the Brexit debate has shown us, and we know it already, but it's shown people in the States and in Brussels and Europe, is how little people in London know and care about Northern Ireland. You know, Boris Johnson, I think, has made the comparison between the border and between sort of borough borders in London. And there really is a very broad and careless attitude. And I think it disguises a number of things. One is that, the economy in Northern Ireland has actually in the last maybe 3 or 4 years begun to pick up. But there's an enormous amount of work to be done. And I think one of the echoes from the Good Friday Agreement is that we have peace, but the level of social and economic change has really lagged. And I would love to see some kind of, I'll put it very broadly, like a Marshall Fund for Northern Ireland. And there can be two ways of that. One, you can have a seed fund. It could even be made up of some of the money that Britain is supposed to pay back to the EU. I'd like to see social impact investing. And I'd like to see the expertise of some of the small countries we talked about, Sweden, Switzerland, because they have no baggage in Northern Ireland, and they're very good at this balanced social economic model, very good at innovation. And that's the kind of expertise should be brought to bear.
We might stop them on their way up there here in Dublin for a while.
Exactly.
Well. Fascinating times. We leave it there. That's Michael O'Sullivan, author of Ireland and the Global Question, and his latest book called The Leveling, What's Next After Globalisation. Michael, thanks a million
Thank
for joining
you very
us.
Much.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings on the new Go Loud app, available to download now in the App Store or on Spotify and the Apple Podcast Player. So just search for Taking Stock and you can find us there. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.